Our final case for this morning is Line Construction Benefit Fund against Allied Electrical Contractors. And when you're ready, Mr. Perkins, we will hear from you.
Hi, good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Tim Perkins, and I represent Allied Electrical Contractors, the appellant in this matter. There are two important questions before this Court. First, whether ERISA grants a multi-employer benefit plan a right to sue for delinquent contributions. And second, whether an employer may be bound to make contributions under the terms of a CBA that requires a signature when he did not execute a letter of assent. The plain language of ERISA specifically grants a right to sue for delinquent contributions only to three parties: participants, beneficiaries, and fiduciaries.
Would you not agree that if we were to agree with you, we would have to overrule our decision in Local 701 against Vanguard Car Rental?
Not at all, Your Honor. The decision in Vanguard did not actually go to the precise provision that's at issue in this case. A careful review of the appellant's brief in that matter, of Vanguard's brief, they only challenged the fact that after the end of the CBA, after we were in the status quo period, that the court's jurisdiction ended because the court was beyond that, and they didn't actually bring up Section 502A3, which is the limitation that the appellant is urging the court to look at today.
By the way, I mean, I don't think any of this is jurisdictional. This has nothing to do with whether a federal question has been raised. The question is whether this is an appropriate party to assert this particular claim under the statute.
Right, Your Honor.
Not a jurisdictional point.
And I agree with that. The problem is that some circuits have called it standing, some circuits have called it subject matter jurisdiction.
You know, our circuit's very picky about what we call subject matter jurisdiction. But on top of the Vanguard case, I mean, we have indicated in a number of instances that a fund is an entirely appropriate party to challenge contributions because it manages the fund. It stands in a fiduciary relationship. Otherwise, you just force people to name the trustees all the time in lieu of the fund. I think that the Seventh Circuit law, anyway, is against you on this point.
Your Honor, I disagree for two important reasons. First of all, the court's decisions in Penn Mutual Life Insurance, or the Peoria Stockyards plan versus Penn Mutual, and also in Central States versus Shilly, the issue was not raised. However, that's the opinions that this court regularly cites to for this proposition. In Penn Mutual, for instance, Judge Posner wrote that a plan can maintain a right of action for a breach of the fiduciary duty, and that's absolutely correct. That's because the breach of fiduciary duty section, Section 409 of ERISA, grants that right to a multi-employer plan. The language at issue in Section 409 specifically states that a person who breaches the duty shall be personally liable to make good to such plan any losses that result thereof. Therefore, in the constitutional sense of standing, there's an injury and there's redressability, and Section 502D1 actually grants the plan the status of an entity to be able to sue under that provision. Also, this court's opinion in Central States versus Shilly, the court was actually addressing withdrawal liability in that case, and in that case, the withdrawal liability is Section 4201 of ERISA, which is the Multi-Employer Pension Plan Amendments Act. Under that plan, Section 4201 also provides or confers a direct right on a multi-employer plan. The language there specifically states that that if an employer withdraws from a multi-employer plan, the employer is liable to the plan and the amount determined under this part to be the withdrawal liability. Thus, the statute confers a right, defines what the extent of the liability is going to be. That's completely different than Section 515. 515 speaks in terms of an employer's obligations. It doesn't define what the liability of the employer is. Specifically, it just says that the employer shall make contributions.
But you don't think employers can just not make contributions and have no one suitable to pursue those contributions. It's the plan.
Not at all, Your Honor.
That has the interest in the contributions. The employer certainly isn't going to sue for that purpose. No individual employee has a right to the general corpus of the plan's funds. It seems that the plan is for this purpose, and you agree that plans have the right under ERISA to sue and be sued.
Absolutely.
They are, in fact, the fiduciary.
Your Honor, I believe...
They certainly can't frivolously deny benefits since they have a fiduciary relationship with...
Your Honor, and if the plaintiff in this case had alleged such in his complaint or put such forth in his statement of undisputed facts, that I think that would be an appropriate issue for the court to recognize. The Ninth Circuit did the exact same thing in the NorCal Plumbing case. The court said there that if that case was before the court, it was completely feasible that the plan could be its own fiduciary. There's no allegations in this complaint that that the plan itself is actually acting as the fiduciary. Now,
what the plan is doing is quite analogous to what happens under the MPAA. The plan says contributions were due for certain months. They weren't paid. You know, for the financial solvency of the fund, they need from time to time to pursue employers who haven't paid what the plan regards as due. I understand that's the other side of your argument, but, you know.
Well, Your Honor, I think the difference is in the actual statutory provisions that give rise to the certain rights. 409 clearly does for a breach of the fiduciary duty. It defines a right and a liability. Section 4201, the MPPAA, also does the same thing. It confers a right and defines the liability, the extent of the liability. 515 is completely different. All it says is that an employer shall make contributions. That's exactly and precisely the reason that 502A3 comes into play. 502A3 is the enforcement mechanism for 515. It's also should be noted that the court or that the language of the remedies provision is very, very crucial too. No other section of ERISA, no other section that's at issue here, has a section defined that where it says what the liability is other than 515. In that section, 502G2, specifically speaks in terms of a fiduciary bringing the claim. There it says, in any action under this subchapter by a fiduciary on behalf of a plan to enforce Section 515. And I think that's the crucial difference between actions brought under the MPPAA, which says an employer is liable to the plan, and says for the withdrawal amount, and the same for the breach of the fiduciary duty and the amount of the profits that the fiduciary makes.
So just to get back, you would not even be here if the trustees of the plan had brought this case.
Not at all, Your Honor. Not for this issue. I would point that out.
I just see no distinction at all between the plan, which after all, in this instance, is acting through its attorneys. It's acting on behalf of the plan as a whole, just as the trustees are. The trustees probably instructed the attorneys to bring the suit.
And albeit that's 99% of the time, that is exactly...
In there somewhere. The plans are like corporations. They're a word.
I agree, except for the limiting language in 502A3. And I just submit, Your Honor, that 502A3 limits it to a participant, a beneficiary, and a fiduciary. And if the plan here had alleged facts and set forth that it is a fiduciary and has that responsibility, I think that it would be a different question. Most of the cases that come before the court, the fiduciary is almost always a member of the action. For instance, all the Central States cases, Mr. Howard McDougall, one of the plan's trustees, is actually a party in the case. I think it's just a slightly different question. I think the Supreme Court actually has spoken somewhat to this issue, too, in the Franchise Tax Board versus CLVT case. The case wasn't cited in the opinion, but that case actually interpreted the exact section of ERISA that's at issue here, 502A3, the enforcement provision. There, the Supreme Court actually stated that ERISA carefully enumerates the parties entitled to seek relief under 502, and it does not provide anyone other than participants, beneficiaries, or fiduciaries with an express cause of action. And, Your Honor, I just believe that without facts alleged that they are a fiduciary, et cetera, I don't believe that the court can assume that they are a fiduciary without such facts that would give rise to that. But even if the court were to find that the plan has standing to bring an action for delinquent contributions, the plan in this case, or the CBA in this case, specifically requires a signed writing. The writing in this case, the letter of assent.
But Allied acted in conformance with the CBA and the trust, didn't it? Monthly submitting checks and signed checks by the principals and so forth?
Well, there was only one. There was only actually one check produced that was signed by the principals. There's no argument that, Your Honor, may I finish my response? There's no argument that the plan actually, or that the conduct could not bind them to the plan. The point is that LEMRA specifically requires strict compliance with the terms of the plan. This plan itself says that a letter of assent is required to bind you to the terms of the CBA. And that's what separates this case from the case in 2004 before the court, the Bricklayers case versus Banner. In that case, there was no such provision that required a signed writing, as the court actually noted in that case. And that's how the court distinguished the Sixth Circuit's case, where the Merriman case, where the court said there's no statutory provision or statutory provision requiring a signature. It's not statutory; it's contractual.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Is he entitled to a refund of the money he's already paid?
Your Honor, the of course the the plan and or the employer in this place hasn't asked for a refund, and I don't think that would be appropriate to do so.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Ariola.
Good morning. Your Honor, what we have here is a collection case disputing 5 months of collections.
How can we be disputing January and February 2007, which obviously post-date the December 7, 2006 letter of assent?
That, presumably the employer did not make the contributions for those 2 months. So those 2 months really are different than the contributions for July, August, and December of 2006.
So none of these arguments that we've been listening to applies with the right of action argument, might, but beyond that, none of these arguments applies to January, February 07, I take it.
That's correct, Your Honor. After December 7th of 2006, there was a writing for which the employer was bound to make the contributions for those 2 months. Mm-hmm. Prior to those 2 months for July, August, and December of 2006, those are the months at issue with regard to whether a course of conduct theory applies to this case or not.
Now, what's your response to your opponent's argument that course of conduct might be available in general, but not here where the agreement seemed to contemplate a written letter of assent?
ERISA funds are third-party beneficiaries, so whether the collective bargaining agreement calls for one thing or another, if the union does not enforce that collective bargaining agreement, that does not have any bearing on what rights that an ERISA fund may have in enforcing its rights as a third-party beneficiary. So even though there may have been a provision requiring the employer to sign a letter of assent, in this case, the employer was under the belief that it had signed a letter of assent. It wasn't until the negotiations in 2006 when the employer was prevented from participating in the negotiations being held by the employer association that it was discovered that it had not signed a letter of assent. When that was discovered, they were not allowed to participate in the negotiations, and shortly after that, they signed the letter of assent. But it did not discover that it was not bound to the letter of assent until that time. However, since 1993, the employer continued to make contributions on a regular basis to the fund.
And these contributions were in the amounts contemplated by the CBA?
That is correct, Your Honor. There is no dispute that the employer did make the contributions necessary under the CBA. The rates were always adhered to.
The rates were adhered to. The covered people were okay.
That is correct. And the fund also performed several audits of the employer, the most recent of which was from 2002 through 2004. And the results of that audit show that it was a $58,000 deficiency. So since there is nothing in the record to show whether that was or was not paid, I assume that that was not an issue at the time and that that deficiency was paid.
And those audits are sent to the employer, results of that?
That is correct, Your Honor. When an audit is completed, it is sent to the employer, and they do have the right to object to any of the contents of the audit so that if they feel that certain figures are incorrect because certain parties may not have been performing collective bargaining work or they were not performing collective bargaining work 100% of the time, then objections like those may be settled during that review process once the audit is completed.
Well, that's in effect a waiver of the objection.
I'm sorry?
I say that is in effect a waiver of the objection.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So let's turn to 1132E, and I guess the question here is whether it's somehow too, I'm not sure if the word is circular or something else, but to say that if a suit can be brought by a participant, beneficiary, fiduciary, can the plan be a fiduciary of itself? I take it it's pretty clear it's not a participant, and it's equally clear it's not a beneficiary. So if it's anything, it's a fiduciary.
That is correct, Your Honor. If you Section 3.9 of ERISA defines a person as an individual, partnership, joint ventureship, corporation, mutual company, joint stock company, trust, estate, unincorporated organization, association, or employee organization. So the corollary, because a fiduciary is defined as a...
Well, in other words, it doesn't matter what business form the fiduciary takes, I assume, from that definition.
That is correct.
So, but that's a somewhat different question than from saying that one is a fiduciary of oneself. Right? If I'm a trustee of a trust, I have fiduciary responsibilities toward the trust. Do I have fiduciary, do I have to deal honestly with myself? I mean, it seems a little meaningless.
It may, Your Honor, but in the context of employer contributions that are due, Section 502D1 does give the plan the right to sue and be sued. And so Section 515 didn't come into being until the amendments of 1980. So what you really have are the original 1974 ERISA provisions, and then you have the amendments of 1980 trying to make sense of, or rather trying to merge what the 1980 amendments were trying to do, and that is to prevent employers from always trying to basically challenge their right to contribute to the plans. And the amendments of 1980, which includes Section 515, were enacted to do just that. Are they the most clear? Probably not. That's why we're here. But it in the automotive Auto Mechanics Local 701 case, the court did deal with that issue and say that Section 515 complements Section 502, and then goes on to discuss Section 5D1, and it is by a combination of those three sections that a plan is conferred a fiduciary status and therefore can sue under its own name.
Okay.
If there are any questions, I thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Perkins? I think you have about a minute. If you want to take a minute, I'll give it to you. you did not have a minute, actually, but I'm giving it to you anyway.
Thank you. No, Your Honor, I don't believe I had any time. The only point I would make is the fact that the contributions from 1993, that was disputed in Mr. Eskridge's deposition. The attorney for the plaintiff actually stated that, and Mr. Eskridge, when it was asked how long has he contributed, he actually stated, I believe since 2002, when I sent my application in for NECA. So there was actually a dispute over that, and I don't believe that that was ever actually established in the record. The only point I would make is that when the plan was enacted, there was when the MPPAA was passed in 1980, as my opposing counsel noted, the only legislative history for ERISA at all is indicated in that part of the plan, in that portion of the statute. And in that portion of the statute, the House manager actually stated that this section is brought to allow the trustees to actually pursue delinquent contributions. And that's the only other point I would make, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll take the case under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.